your source for everything paranormal. Para-X. The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Welcome to Stirring the Cauldron here on the Para-X Radio Network. My guest tonight is author Carl F. Neal, and he wrote a terrific book called Incense. It's about the crafting and use of magical scents, and I've got to say that I learned more about incense in the book's introduction alone than what most books have on the subject in the entire book. Carl's been a professional incense maker since 1995, and a practicing pagan for 10 years before that. His fascination with incense stretches back to his childhood when he first discovered it, and that was at the age of 12, and he's grown more and more interested and enthusiastic about it every year since. Long before he discovered the spirituality of Mother Earth, he understood the power of scent in daily life. Carl travels the country and speaks about incense and its uses anywhere he can, and his deep love of incense and the magical community drives him forward every day. Hey, Carl, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Marla. Appreciate having the chance to speak with you tonight.
I think this is I learned so much that I think this is a topic that people are going to be really surprised to find out about, certain aspects of it anyway. And like I said a minute ago, I was blown away just reading the introduction, because if I thought I knew anything at all about incense, you removed any illusions that I might have had. But let's start off by talking about the power of scent in our lives, both in the mundane and magical worlds. And I think a lot of people don't realize it, but scents do affect our lives all the time on a regular basis, don't they?
Oh, well, scent has a massive impact on the human brain. It's really kind of the most overlooked of our senses, I think. But yet it's also the most primitive of all of our senses. The brain actually processes scent in two completely different ways with two completely different parts of the brain. So what we think of as the sense of smell works pretty much like all the other impulses that we get from our ears, from our eyes. It goes through kind of a pre-processing unit, and then it's sent into the brain that interprets it. But in addition to that, there's a much more primitive aspect to scent, and part of our sense of smell is connected directly to a very primitive part of the brain. And scientists to this day aren't entirely sure of what happens, how that affects us, but some experiments have shown that people who have lost their sense of smell still feel a dramatic impact from the presence of certain types of natural incense. So wow. It's affecting us in ways that we can't even guess at yet. There are a lot of people doing a lot of research on it, so maybe in the next 10 years we'll have better answers. But yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why it's so potent and so powerful. You know, who hasn't walked into a bakery and smelled something in there and just instantly been transported back to your grandmother's kitchen? Mm-hmm. You know, it's just very, very potent and touches us on a very primitive level, I think.
Mm-hmm. You know, it would seem to some, to me actually in the beginning, before I read the book, that the process of making our own incense versus buying it commercially would be a rather huge and costly chore, but it's not as daunting as one might think, is it?
Not at all. And really, we owe that knowledge to a lot of different people. Just in the 70s or even in the 80s, I think the basic concepts that we had in the West of incense and incense making were really not very accurate of how things were done in the ancient world. You know, most of the commercial incense that we have here in America is made with what they call incense blanks, which are essentially fireworks punks, and they're soaked in some fragrance oils, and then they're burned, and as we all know, they're very, very strong in scent, sometimes very strong in terrible scents, and that's really what most of us grew up thinking incense was. That I'm certainly one of those people. When I started making incense, that's the exact type I was making. But luckily, some enlightened people got a hold of me and introduced me to some other incense making techniques and showed me how intensely powerful natural incense is. I know that for a lot of us who practice magic, who do any kind of ritual work, instructions that are given are often light some incense. And that's it. That's all that incense is mentioned in the entire process. But when you start delving into natural incense and the gifts of goddess that are available to us, it opens a whole new universe for you. It really does.
It does. And I'm going to get into that a little bit deeper, but I just had a question from the chat room talking about scents, as we were. And he wants to know, is there any truth to scents like vanilla, for example, being effective romantically with men because they relate kind of to food smells and that kind of relates to romance and all that stuff?
Well, that's a great question. And the answer is on a couple of different levels. The first is that certainly scent has a great deal to do with romance, for physical attraction, for enhancement of physical activities. There's no question about that. And certainly, I think it's pretty clear to people who work with herbs and aromatics on a regular basis that, yeah, vanilla is one of those scents that has a particular impact on the male psyche. I can't tell you exactly why, but I can say you at least anecdotally that it has that effect on me as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that lots of men are that way. So I would say that, yeah, that's not simply a myth, that really is true. There are other scents that have similar effects. Sandalwood is one of those. Patchouli is one of those.
Oh, I love patchouli. That's my favorite.
And with patchouli, what you generally find with people is they either absolutely love it or absolutely hate it. Very few people are neutral about it. And I think that says a lot for its power as well. It either attracts you or it repels you. It never leaves you alone.
No, it definitely attracts me. I just, I don't know why. Maybe it's a kickback to the 60s or 70s. I don't know, but patchouli is absolutely my favorite.
Well, and it's a great aromatic to work with incense making, as long as you're working with patchouli that's been properly prepared. Most herbs that we work with, most of the aromatics, don't require any kind of special treatment. You dry them, you powder them, you put them to use. But patchouli is an unusual herb in that the patchouli that we think of, that classic scent, comes out during a very long fermenting process that patchouli leaves are put through. So if you've ever grown patchouli in your own garden and then dried it and burned it and wondered why it didn't smell like patchouli, that's why. It's actually been fermented. So just kind of an off-the-wall fact there about patchouli, which I went from being a hater to a lover as I worked with it more and more in incense. So I'm a rare case of someone who made the change.
Yeah. Well, one thing about some patchouli, and this leads into the next question I was going to ask you anyway, some patchouli that you get commercially can give you a whopping headache. And I was reading in your book about people who sometimes do get headaches from incense. And when I read why that happens, dipping and blanks in particular, it was quite thought-provoking and a little bit scary. So let's talk a bit about why that happens with commercially made incense, maybe starting with the difference between synthetic and natural scents, and take it from there.
Absolutely. And this is something that I have talked about extensively, and something that I really like to educate people on. And I'll admit that in the earliest days when I discovered this information, and I don't want to sound like I discovered it. I should say when people introduced me to these concepts, I really was kind of radical about it. I preached completely against, you know, synthetic incense in any shape or form. And as the years have gone by and I've learned more, I don't feel quite that strongly. But I will say that most people are unaware of what the impacts are of the incense that they burn. Many of the most well-known brands of incense and a lot of the incense made locally in shops is made through the process that you were talking about, incense dipping. And dipping uses blanks, which can be sticks, they can be cones, and what they're supposed to be is unscented incense, so that you soak it in a fragrance oil, that's what gives it its scent. When it's burned, then that scent is released. So it's a good idea. It's very industrial, because you can make massive quantities of incense that way, and I confess that that is how I started making incense. I owned a shop. I wanted to make my own incense, and that's exactly how I did it. What I didn't know, what I had to learn later, was that a lot of the processes that are used for making that type of incense are essentially untested from a scientific point of view, and they produce a product that has a strong scent and really doesn't have anything else going for it and has a lot of drawbacks to it. I think probably all of us know someone who will say that they're allergic to incense. And there are people who do have allergic reactions to any kind of particulate, any kind of smoke whatsoever. But in general, people who feel like they're allergic to incense feel that way because it gives them headaches, the smell overwhelms them, and most of the time that isn't actually a reaction to being allergic to incense. It's a reaction to the synthetic materials that are in the incense. The oil that's used in a lot of incense making was never designed to be burned. A lot of it is designed as a flavoring or to be used in aromatherapy lamps, things like that, that use very gentle heat. And they weren't intended to be burned. On top of that, a lot of incense makers who make this type of incense use cutting agents. And we've smelled how strong that incense is, so it's not unreasonable to want to take that smell level down a little bit. That's one thing that cutting agents do, because they're basically an unscented synthetic oil. They're kind of a blank oil, and it will take that scent down a little bit, but the primary purpose is to stretch the fragrance oils, which are more expensive, out as far as you possibly can. Get as many sticks or cones of incense as you can possibly make. And so, as a result, they use these cutting agents. I did it one time myself. Dipropylene glycol is one of the, called DPG, is probably the most common cutting agent that's used. And it has never been scientifically evaluated for use in this type of a product. If you read the material safety data sheet on it, it actually says, do not burn, releases poisonous gas when burned.
Nice.
So we have that whole aspect of these synthetic oils that can cause health problems, especially to people who are sensitive. So they may feel they're allergic to incense. They're actually having a reaction to the burning of these synthetic, often petroleum-based chemicals. And if you couple that with the blanks themselves, which, and I don't want to say this categorically, but many, perhaps the vast majority of those blanks, are made with the leftover materials from the manufacture of plywood. So it's wood of questionable quality mixed with unknown types of glues that's been ground into a powder and glued onto a stick or glued back into cone shape. So you don't know, formaldehyde is released from these things, all sorts of chemicals can be released from them. And then you add that with the synthetic oils that we've already got, and you have a pretty perfect storm of getting people blinding headaches and, you know, running them out of a room from the choking smoke.
Yeah. Well, let's touch on the big debate now, herbs versus oils.
Well, and that really comes down to a matter of your own training and your own preference. It really does. I am a proponent of what's called whole herb incense, meaning that we typically will use nothing but woods, herbs, resins, and we don't use oils. And I say typically because I break every rule I've ever created, I think. So I do use oils occasionally. There are some scents that you can't achieve in any way except an oil. But I generally urge people to use the highest quality essential oils that they can get and stay away from the synthetic fragrance oils in most cases. I will say that I have one exception to that. If you feel the need to include musk in your incense and you want a musk oil, then I would urge you to use a synthetic one in spite of the drawbacks that come from it, simply because I'm not a fan of using animal products in incense. But apart from that, sure, you can definitely use essential oils. I talk about that a little bit in the book, at what stage you can add the oils in, and certainly there are some scents that you won't be able to achieve any other way. You can't get rose any other way without using an adder or an oil. You have to use it in a liquid form to achieve that scent. But in the incense that I make, for the most part, I don't use oils.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think another thing that bears discussion is the use of charcoal when burning loose incense. I mean, I always liked the fact that when I light a cake of charcoal, it throws off lovely sparks and burns across the cake, and you know, was just kind of enchanted by that. And after reading what you wrote about that, I'm very definitely having second thoughts about using that variety of charcoal anymore.
I think it's something that really does set people back on their heels when they think about it a little bit. And yes, I am not a huge fan of what's most commonly called self-lighting charcoal. And most of the brands, the little rolls of round charcoal bricks that you can buy in your local Pagan or New Age store are of that type. It'll usually say it in great big letters right across the package, and it's actually used as a selling point. But I think what's not really commonly understood is that all of that, and the sparking is cool as long as you keep your hands away from it, because it'll certainly burn you. But it is nice to watch, especially in a completely dark room, and watch the little sparks crawl across the surface. But all of that is caused by potassium nitrate being embedded inside that charcoal. And, yeah, potassium nitrate, or also called saltpeter, can have a place in ritual, but you really need to think about it, know that it's there, understand its magical properties and all of the implications of using that. Plus, of course, you have to deal with that smell that I think we're all familiar with. When you light one of those bricks of charcoal and you go back to it a few minutes later, it really shouldn't have a scent, but it does. And it's a very unpleasant one, and again, it's that saltpeter that's burning inside of it. So you have to deal with that, the magical implications. You have to deal with the scent, which any incense you put on it, you have to overcome that scent so you can smell what you actually want to smell. So you have both of those issues. And then the worst part of all is that it makes your charcoal burn very, very hot. It's an oxidizer, so it supplies lots of oxygen to that charcoal so it can burn much hotter than it normally would. So if you've ever had the experience where maybe you've taken a frankincense tear and dropped it onto one of those burning charcoal briquettes and it melts in about 1 second and then
this
inky cloud of smoke comes off of it,
It's
not because there's anything wrong with your frankincense. It's just because your charcoal's way too hot. So it's melting, burning, scorching that frankincense in just a matter of seconds. If you use a charcoal that doesn't have potassium nitrate in it, especially if you use a low-scent charcoal, you can put that exact same tear onto your burning charcoal, and it's going to last 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, depending on exactly how hot the charcoal brick is. And it won't ever give that horrible, unpleasant stink, and you don't have to worry about constantly scraping things off of your charcoal so they won't burn and smell terrible. So, again, that's something that people, you know, don't really think a lot about. Instructions are given to light a charcoal brick and then put your incense on it. And, you know, we don't really think every time about what lies in between and how to pick the right charcoal. I certainly never did. I can't guess how many thousands and thousands of bricks of self-lighting charcoal I sold. Even after I wrote the book, I continued to sell it. It's just people had to listen to my speech first. but if they still chose to buy it, they certainly could, and I don't think that, you know, people should run out and throw all of their charcoal in the garbage. It's certainly very useful if you're burning outdoors in windy conditions. It'll stay lit very easily. But what surprises people is when they find out that they can buy charcoal that doesn't have any of these drawbacks. It actually creates no scent. And brick for brick, it costs the same. It's just a matter of looking for it or asking your local retailer to order it for you. And so if you're an informed consumer, you can spend the exact same amount of money and get something that's significantly higher quality.
Right. I think that's a really important point to make. Now, I'm a really big proponent of incense for magical use, and you bring up a very valid point in the book about how negative energies can collect in commercially made products. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely it can. And I would extend that to say that can even happen when you make your own incense if you're not careful about how and when you do it. But the reality is that most of the incense that we buy is made offshore. It's made thousands of miles away from us. We don't know who's handling it. We don't know what materials they're putting into it. We don't know what happens to it on the way. Certainly, we have a lot of concerns with products that we import into the United States, not knowing about how the labor force that created that was treated. We don't know, was an equitable arrangement made? Were products taken out of the forest in an unethical fashion? We don't know any of the history of these materials, even if it's a completely natural type of incense. So by making your own incense, you have control over all of that. You know exactly what's going into it. You don't have to worry about negative energies that you couldn't even identify traveling along with that incense. Because one thing that all practiced incense makers and users understand is that when you burn that incense, especially if you do it in a magic circle, it's going to release all the energy that's inherent in it and all the energy it's collected in the meantime. So while you may release a lot of positive energy that you can use, that you can alter with your will, you may receive some unexpected negative energy in that same bundle. And even if you're prepared for it, it may be difficult to get the full use out of the incense because it has that negative component to it.
Mm-hmm.
If you make the incense yourself or if you buy it from a local producer that you trust, then you can be assured that all of the energy that's in it is positive. And this is something I really like new incense makers to understand, that you can inadvertently put your own negative energy into incense when you make it. So I really stress to people that when you make incense, it should be a relaxing, pleasant process. It's very quick. People would be surprised that in 10 to 15 minutes, you can make a large batch of incense. It's not as difficult as at least I was led to believe 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So you certainly have the ability to do that. And as you work it, you do it in a positive environment, you feed that positive energy right back into that incense. So on top of all the energy that all the ingredients have gained from Mother Nature, you put your own alignment of that energy. You set it so that it's going to accomplish the goals that you want it to accomplish, and you avoid negativity. I tell people to unplug the phone, put on some pleasant music, make incense when you know you won't be interrupted so that you can have that elevated mood while you make it, and it will make a tremendous difference in the energy that's released once you actually use it.
It's similar to any kind of workings that we do, magical workings.
And I agree, and I think that it's something that, especially as you've been in the craft for a long time, that's something that's easy to forget. That you go, oh yeah, I need to get this done because, you know, everyone from the coven's going to be over in 3 hours. I better get it done right now. And you can just add that negativity in, and then when the night's over, everybody looks at each other and wonders what was wrong. Something just wasn't right that night. And sure, that can happen with anything. And certainly with bad mood when your little to-do list says it's time to make incense, you need to move things around so that you can come back, because incense is supposed to be relaxing when you make it or when you burn it, either way. So if you don't feel relaxed while you're doing it, you should put it off and do it some other time.
Good, good, good words to grow by and live by. How important is shape in incense crafting, and which do you personally prefer, recommend, or is it just kind of like, in general, a matter of personal choice?
Well, one of the great things that people learn when they start making natural incense is that the first step, if you're going to make what we call self-burning incense or self-combusting incense, which is just like the sticks and cones we're used to, that you light them and they burn on their own, they don't require charcoal. If you're going to make that type of incense, you start off by making what's kind of like fragrant Play-Doh. It's really more, to me it's like cookie dough in consistency. So it's this incredible artistic medium. Unfortunately, I have no artistic skills whatsoever. So the best I can do is to roll it out flat and cut it with cookie cutters if I want to be creative. But others, far more talented than I, have picked up the same medium and created these unbelievable things made out of incense. So they're very ephemeral. They dry, and then we burn them, and then they're gone. So it's an art form that I truly love. But when it comes to the utilitarian aspect of the shape of incense, really, to me, the ultimate form of incense is what we call the joss stick. And let me back up just a second there and explain what that means. There are basically two kinds of incense sticks. There are masala sticks and there are joss sticks. And then these are common terms that we have developed in the West. If you go to Asia, you will find that there are far more in-depth, detailed technical definitions that would separate these two things into far more categories. But for us, the joss stick is a solid stick of incense material. It doesn't have that familiar wooden bamboo rod up the center like a fireworks punk does. It's just a solid piece of incense, like a very thin cone. And I have always found that to be the easiest form of incense to deal with. It's the most flexible. I think we've all experienced lighting a cone and it burns halfway down and it goes out. I think we've all been there. And that can be, a lot of different factors can cause that. Moisture buildup in the incense can cause that. But a lot of times it's simply that the incense doesn't have a great enough surface area. It's not able to burn down through the center of the cone because the material is simply so thick and it just isn't prone to burn. What we're trying to do with incense is we're trying to take things that may not normally burn at all and make them burn in a very steady, controlled way. So when you make a thin stick like that looks very much like a dried stick of spaghetti, you have a tremendous amount of surface area, and it doesn't take very much heat for it to keep going. Unlike a cone that may be the thickness of a pencil, it has to generate a lot of heat in order to keep burning, but these thin little joss sticks don't. And so that gives you the greatest flexibility. You can combine aromatics that you might not be able to burn in any other form unless you put them on top of charcoal. So I found that to be the most utilitarian type of incense in shape. Masala sticks have their place as well, because sometimes you'll use materials that are too soft to be able to support themselves, and you need that wooden rod to hold the whole thing together. So sometimes it's necessary, but those sticks get in the way. They actually make it harder for the incense to keep burning. So I try not to do those. Cones are the easiest, on the other hand, for new incense makers to create. The cone shape is very easy to roll. Takes a little more practice, a little more skill, or if you're like me, it just takes some specialized hardware in order to make joss sticks. I kind of cheat, and I use an extruder so I can make sticks that are very consistent thickness.
Just like pasta, huh?
but I always, in workshops, we always start out by making cones because, I don't know, there's just something satisfying about it. You start out with kind of a four-sided pyramid, and you roll it into this beautiful round cone, and they're a lot of fun to make. They just may not burn as well.
Now, what? Also, there's a question about the proper storage of incense to ensure its longevity.
Well, it certainly has been said. There's a famous ancient saying in the incense world that incense material never goes bad, that we'll never throw it away. It will always be used in incense. And I agree with that on a philosophical level, but I suggest that you store your incense very carefully. For the most part, incense should be stored in airtight containers and out of sunlight. Out of all light is preferable, but definitely out of sunlight. All herbalists know, anybody who works in aromatherapy or works with essential oils understands that a lot of the energy in these materials come from the sun, and what the sun gives, the sun can take away. So you want to keep your incense stored out of sunlight. And preferably in an airtight container and not mixed with other types of incense. So a whole lot of conditions there. And, of course, most of my incense isn't stored quite that thoroughly. I'd like to say that I'm super careful and I store everything in its own individual jar, but I don't. I'm a realist. I keep some commercial incense in its original packages. I have three or four little chests of drawers that are just stuffed with incense. Some of it's wrapped in plastic, some of it's not. But definitely what you store in a sealed container is going to last a whole lot longer. The scent will stay strong because all of this scent that we smell, everything positive that we want out of incense, comes from essential oils. The difference between making whole herb incense and making incense with oils is that when you make it with oils, those essential oils have been distilled out of the original herbaceous material and put into liquid form and then returned back to incense. Whereas with whole herb incense, we just use the essential oils that naturally exist inside the materials themselves. Either way, if you expose this made incense to air, these essential oils can evaporate. You have to be careful when you grind materials into powder to make it into incense, that you don't overheat it, because that makes the essential oils evaporate, and you don't overexpose it to air for the same reason. So storing your materials well will keep them at their peak of strength for the longest amount of time. If you get lazy like I do sometimes, your incense isn't going to go bad at any point, but as time goes by, the strength of the scent will lessen. And if it's a combination of different materials, as most incense is, some materials are going to lose their oils faster than others, so it may actually change the scent of the incense over time.
Well, I'm one of the lazy ones, but there is a bonus to that because I keep my incense in a cabinet as well. And when I open the drawers, oh, my God, it smells so good in here. You know, the mix.
Isn't that amazing? And that's kind of recycling of those essential oils, because you're not losing them. You're just transferring them from your incense to your cabinet. And I have, like I said, I have several wooden chests that I keep incense in. And, yeah, I think that someday the chests themselves are going to smell better than any incense I can put in there, just because they've had many years absorbing those oils.
I know. It's fantastic. Let's talk a little bit about empowering our incense for magical use, because you do talk about that in the book, and I know there's a little more to it than just good intentions.
Well, that is the beginning point, and that's one of the things that I recommend. I think that one of the greatest things you can do as an incense maker is to make incense as a gift. I think that is one of the most tremendous things. I love making my own ritual incense because, you know, I have control over it. I know exactly what's in it, and I'm with it from, you know, birth to death. So I really like that. But making incense as a gift for somebody else is not just a gift of scent. It certainly is that, and you want a scent that the receiver is going to enjoy. But it's also a gift of energy, and it's your energy, and it's the energy in the materials that you work with. So you have the ability to infuse, like we were talking earlier. You don't want to make incense when you're in a bad mood. You're going to infuse that negative energy into it. And you also run the risk of aligning the natural energy within that incense in the wrong way, to hit those, to align with the negative energies that you're putting in there rather than the positive energies that you want to give as that gift. And certainly if you're going to use it in circle yourself, you don't want to bring your own negative energies in. So part of the process And it's really a fun part when people start making their own incense. This is one of the stages that they don't want to stop. When you have it in this kind of dough form and you're working with it, you're squeezing it through your fingers. I always recommend that people wear gloves when they make incense, but I would say easily a third of the people that I work with who make incense don't want to wear gloves. They want to feel that incense directly. They want to be able to touch its energy, have its energy touch them as closely as possible. So there's a meditative process that one goes through at that point, and that is a way to very strongly align the energies that are within it. Certainly, you're always infusing your own energy into it every time you need it. That's a little bit of your energy that's going into that incense. And so if you work with it for a very long time, you can infuse it with a great deal of your personal energy. But how you focus your thoughts, we all know that, you know, will and energy are what makes the universe. It's what makes magic. And that's certainly true with incense making. Your will, your thoughts, as you're working on that incense, is aligning the energies that were given to you by nature so that they will be attuned and ready to do a particular job. You know, if you are creating a prosperity incense for one of your friends who maybe is a little down on their luck at the moment, you really don't want to watch Jeopardy while you're doing that. Because your brain is not going to be focused on what you want this incense to do. It's going to be highly distracted, so you won't be aligning all of those natural energies that are in that incense. But by focusing on what you want to do, by using, and I've known some magicians far more potent than I am who can make intensely powerful incense that is, every drop of the energy within it is perfectly aligned with their intentions. And it's because of that focus, it's that use of will that's so critical to magic, you want to use it throughout the process, not simply when you're standing in circle doing a ritual. You want to have that force of will to align those energies throughout the entire incense-making process. If you harvest materials yourself, you want to do it from that moment, from the moment you cut a piece of plant and process it, dry it, grind it, roll it into incense. You want to use that will that you have to align those energies throughout that entire process to get the most result that you possibly can.
Mm-hmm. Now, in talking about rituals, for those who may not know the kind of rituals that we do or use incense for it, I know it's personal choice, but do you have some favorite incenses for particular rituals, the ones that, you know, are very common?
Sure, I absolutely do. And I would say that what a lot of people don't think about, and I think it's in America we're kind of isolated, is that incense is really a part of most religions. Most religions, most ways of thinking spiritually, if they don't already embrace incense, certainly can. The Catholic Church is a perfect example. The Eastern Orthodox Church, probably the largest consumers of commercial incense would be Buddhists. So it cuts across many different cultures who use it. But certainly the way that the neo-pagans, and I don't want to go through the entire litany because we know there are a lot of different labels that can be applied to people who follow nature-based religions. All of us incorporate incense in our own particular ways. I have done, when I first started making natural incense, I'll take us aside for really, I promise, a short story.
No, I love stories. Go.
Well, I was a relatively new natural incense maker, and just to do a ritual on Samhain, Halloween, which involved about 15 different kinds of incense, because I was so proud of all of my new incense-making skills. So I had incense lit everywhere in the room you can possibly imagine, in the, you know, smoke detectors in the building. I was not dressed for public consumption, but yet I did have to go out and stand in my glass storefront in order to turn off the smoke alarms. So I will say that I've been through a lot of personal evolution when it comes to the use. But I like to use the joss-stick form of incense because it does not produce a great deal of smoke, and so you can burn several types at once. But I do have one particular blend of incense that I do truly love. I've made a lot of incense over the years. Some of it I have liked a lot. Some of it has been very utilitarian. Some of it will never be shown in print because it just didn't turn out very well. But I have one. It's listed in the book for quarters, but what it actually is intended to be is an altar incense. And it's a combination of sandalwood, myrrh, patchouli, and copal, which copal is Central South American tree resin. It's a very generic term. It can talk about a lot of different types of tree resin. I prefer golden copal as my favorite. But that particular combination, what strikes me so much about it, and I was very surprised the first time I burned it, is that the power it releases is intense. It has ingredients that represent all four of the elements that we recognize in quarters in pagan ritual. And for some reason that I've never been able to understand, this combination of ingredients somehow comes out smelling like other ingredients are present when they're not, such as the strong scent of dragon's blood, although there is no dragon's blood resin in it whatsoever. And I can't help but think that it is the combination of these four different elements coming together and kind of bridging the gap between the mundane world, the physical world, and the astral world, and allowing in even more scents that aren't even physically present. So that is my particular favorite. I like to always have that burning on my altar. I don't do a lot of formal ritual anymore. I use a more casual form of magic now, but even so, I always like to have that four quarters incense burning whenever possible.
Those are my favorite scents that you threw together. I'm going to have to get some of that. I've got a couple of questions from the chat room, and one goes back to the rituals. Mufi is asking, why do we use incense for sacred stuff? Is it because it all goes up in the air?
That is a great question, Lucy. And if you haven't noticed, I am kind of an incense nerd. So I love incense. I use it anywhere and everywhere that I possibly can, and have spent many hours meditating over what is incense, what's its purpose, why do we use it. And typically, I think that in most pagan circles, incense is used to represent either the elements of fire or the elements of air. Obviously the fire because the incense burns, and air because the scent and the smoke rises into the air. But I like to point out to people that it actually represents all four, because whatever materials we're using in natural incense were grown from the earth and could not have grown without water. That's an essential to life. So really all four elements are present. And I also like to point out to people that when we roll incense, whether we're making cones or sticks or coils or whatever shape we're making, we have to actually add water back in to that dry mixture in order to turn it into incense. You have to have all four elements present. So what we really use it for is to take all of that energy. You think about sandalwood, for example. It takes decades for a sandalwood tree to mature to the point where it's producing oil. It only grows in very limited specific places. The sun has to be down on it for a very long time every day. It has to have water to drink. It has to be in the exact right kind of soil. So it's gathered up all of these natural energies day after day for decades before we take it and we go to burn it in incense. So we are taking all of those energies that have gathered up over the decades, or in the case of amber resin, over hundreds of thousands of years, and we're releasing that for us to use. We're turning it into available energy for us to manipulate, for us to use within our rituals. So every stream of smoke that's going up, that's energy that's available to you. We have lots of different ways that we raise energy for magic, but I think incense is one of the most overlooked because it's passive. You simply light it, and it releases energy that it's been storing up like a battery. It's not something that you have to focus on and draw the energy out. It comes out very willingly. So we need to recognize that and direct and use that energy within our magic, and it will make things much more potent. It is virtually free energy that's there for you to use that is purely natural. It's wholesome. It's from Mother. And it's a gift to us to use. And that's what incense is for in magic.
Well, I agree with you because I use it consistently. I just don't not use it. I've got another question from Ceiling Cat, and she wonders if you ever used honey and cubeb berries in incense.
Another great question. And actually, honey is something that I use very regularly in incense. There is a type of incense made in Japan that's called Niriko, which was the first of this type of incense that I learned about. And I will give a shout out to David Aller and the folks at his online list, Alice's Restaurant, which sadly is no longer with us. But those people introduced me to this concept of using honey as a binder, as a kind of glue to hold your incense together. You can't make self-burning incense like that. This type of incense has to be burned on charcoal, but the results are nothing short of amazing. When I first used honey, I thought, this is going to stink. I've burned white sugar before. I know how terrible that smells. This isn't going to work in incense. Well, when you blend it with some woods, some resins, honey is not white sugar. They're very, very different things. You let this combination age a little bit, and then you burn it on charcoal, and you will be stunned at how good it smells. You will maybe give it to a friend as a gift and say, yes, I made this, and they're going to say, no, you didn't. There's no way, because the scent is strongly perfumed, completely natural, simply an awesome, awesome ingredient, and a very ancient one. It's very likely that that type of incense originated out of herbal medication, where honey would be used to bind pills, herbal pills that were given to patients. It not only held the ingredients together, but it made it a lot more palatable to swallow. And my theory's always been at some point somebody got some of it too hot and recognized this was also a form of incense. So an excellent question, Ceiling Cat, and it really, really is a great incense ingredient. You'll find a section about that in the book.
One more question from the chat. Patsy wants to know, what is Nag Champa made from?
Oh, Patsy, you have asked the $10 million question. This is something that we have debated within the incense community for as long as I have been a part of it. Now, Nag Champa originally was a completely natural flower product. What we get packaged as Nag Champa now certainly is not that. No company who produces Nag Champa has ever been willing to come forward with an ingredient list. Very few incense companies do. In fact, as far as I know, Shoyedo Incense out of Japan is the only company that publishes their ingredients for their incense. So people like to keep that as kind of a secret. But I'll tell you what I know about the common type of Satya Sai Baba Nag Champa incense that we're all used to seeing. I believe that it is hand-rolled because I have seen fingerprints on the surface of it. So that's a pretty strong indicator. And the sticks are very inconsistent in their size and shape. So I would say that it is made by hand. But I think it's pretty much the consensus of all the incense makers I know that there are at least some synthetic fragrances within it. There may very well be a lot of natural ingredients, but there's no doubt in my mind, simply because of the strength of the smell when it's in the box, that there are synthetic fragrance oils that are included in it. Please don't sue me. I'm not stating this as a fact, but since no one will release the list of ingredients, I think it's a pretty safe bet that at least some synthetic ingredients are in there. But it also does link back to the previous question. There's a pretty strong undercurrent of honey in there as well. So I think it's a combination of natural and synthetic. I know a lot of people who use Nag Champa in ritual. For me, I find the scent to be overwhelming, and I do not use it. But I say that if it works for you, if it helps helps you to focus and to shift into a magical frame of mind, then by all means use it.
Okay. We're rapidly running out of time. I have one more quick question. What do you think of the generic Himalayan healing incense, like traditional Tibetan style incense?
Well, I will say that there is some absolutely amazing incense being brought in from the Himalayas right now. There is a project that's taking place over there in conjunction with a relatively large incense seller here in America, where they have actually gone into individual Tibetan villages and have taught the villagers how to roll natural incense. It's then packaged, exported to the U.S., and sold here, and it's amazing. I cannot say enough about it. I love it. I do get a box at least once or twice a year. You'll find that these are their incense cylinders, or they're very, very thick jaw sticks. They're oftentimes a little bit soft, so you have to handle them carefully. But the scent is extremely authentic Himalayan. You'll find that there's a deep musky scent to it, and they use a lot of high-quality sandalwood and a lot of high-quality frankincense or olibanum. Really, I've been very impressed with all of it that I've encountered.
Right. We are so rapidly running out of time, but before we have to go, I want to make sure you get the chance to tell everybody where they can find your book and also give out information on your website. And because there's like 1,000 questions that we didn't get answered, and you have a new book coming out called Incense Magic, I'm already inviting you back when that comes out so we can talk more about that. And meanwhile, let's give out your website.
Great, Marla. Yeah, I will definitely come back when the new book comes out. The current book is all about making incense. The new book is all about using incense. So even if you never feel like making incense, just wait till early March. You're going to have a book that's going to teach you 1,000 new things that you never knew. My website is Incense Books. That's INCENSEBOOKS, incensebooks.com. The website is currently undergoing a facelift in preparation for the release of the new book. So if you find any broken links, just check back in a couple of days and it ought to be fixed. My webmaster is hard at work. But you'll definitely find some information there. You'll find some recipes for incense making you've never seen before. The incense book and my second book, The Magic Toolbox, are both available through most large retailers. But I would urge everybody out there to please go to your local bookstore or go to your local magic shop and ask them to order it. Incense is printed by Llewellyn, so it's very easy for any retailer to get. I'm a really strong supporter of buying local, supporting your small local shops. You know, buy it online if you need to. Buy it online from a giant like Amazon if that's necessary. But try and support those local shops and get them to order a copy for you.
Good. Because I think everybody needs to run out and buy these books, honestly.
Well, I agree with you completely, Marla.
Okay, I just got a cue that we can talk for another couple minutes if we need to, so this is good. because maybe I can get another question in, which will be great. You talked about in your book the term listening to incense. Can you explain
yes,
what that
and
means?
This is an Asian concept that I think is the most beautiful thing I ever learned about incense. And goes back to that same group of people, David Aller and a lot of his folks, who introduced me to this. I think a lot of people are familiar with the Japanese tea ceremony, a very formal, very ritualistic thing. It's a great honor to be asked to participate in it. A lot of people are unaware of the Kodo ceremony, which is the incense equivalent to the tea ceremony, and actually the same type of incense I described earlier, the incense made with honey, is actually burned in the tea ceremony. So there's that connection. But the concept of listening to incense grows out of that tradition. And the idea is that when we burn incense, when we burn even just a single aromatic, we're not simply smelling it. We're learning from that. We're listening to what it has to say to us. And it's something that I urge people to do as they grow and experiment with incense, is to take time to listen to each one of your ingredients. Spend some time with a single aromatic, burn it on some charcoal, and stop, quiet your mind, and let that speak to you. It's great to get books that have lists of, well, you know, this herb goes with the sign of Aries, and this herb is associated with the moon, and we can have all of those kinds of associations, and they're great starting points, but that's all they are, starting points. When you listen to incense, when you listen to herbs, and you let them speak to you directly, they might whisper some things in your ear that you would never hear any other way. They may tell you to use them in ways that no one else has ever thought of or that other people have rejected. So this concept is not only meditative, but it's highly informative. And if you stop, if you still your thoughts and allow that information to come into you and listen to that incense, you're going to find new ways to use it that will be potent beyond what you thought was possible. It's a very, very long process that I could talk about. That's the heart of it. But I can recommend there are several great books about Kodo and Japanese incense that talk about it. And not to plug my own book too many times, but the new book that's coming out also addresses it, as does the first one, including there are great games that you can play, where as a group you can sit and listen to incense together. Everybody share their different interpretations of it. But it's sort of a way to stop and smell the roses and really listen to what the roses have to say.
That's great. And as I said, we will have you back and talk some more about this because it's one of my loves. Hang on, and after we go off the air, hang on with us for just a minute so we can thank you properly. But thank you so much for being here. It was a pleasure.
And well, thank you for having me, Marla. I really appreciate it, and I'll be happy to come back anytime.
Yay! And I want to thank everybody else for listening in tonight as well. And until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
This has been another edition of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooke. Be sure to tune in next week at the same time for another great guest and more fun. Any